Oh, 71.
Well, and I think that I had helped to recruit good people for the English department. I think we've been very successful in the people we've recruited, and we seem to be doing better and better at that. Our good. Young people are very good.
Good. Do you remember anything about Alfred Kaysen?
Oh, yeah. Well, Alfred is a temperamental person. And he was moody and very sensitive to his prerogatives. And people resented it.
They did?
Sure. Because he was here one day a week, and this was at a time when more of us were teaching Monday, Wednesday, Friday than now. Mm-hmm. And there was resentment. You know, I think some of it was just plain envy. He was a tremendously successful and able and visible mm-hmm. person, and the institution understandably tried to make as much of that as it could. I mean, I still have people, not recently, but up until a few years ago, people saying, oh, isn't that where Alfred Kaysen is? So, and he was not an easy colleague. I mean, you know, he wanted what he wanted, and he could be reasoned with about things, but he was petulant.
I remember when Jack Ludwig came in and told me about him, told me that there was how good he was and how important it was for us to get him, and that he had an offer from Northwestern which was above our salary scale. And I went to bat with the vice president for personnel up in Albany. His name slips me now. And explained the situation. And the man was in my corner. He said, I'll see what I can do. And he was able to work it out by setting up the distinguished professorship. Mm. And we got the first distinguished professor, and that was Kaysen. But he couldn't do it without offering also Buffalo a chance to have a distinguished mm-hmm. professor. That's the relativism within the system that you're still up against.
Yeah. Yeah.
Buffalo finally...
They got Fiedler, didn't
they? Came up with one. Now, the man, the actual man considered was in political science, and it he was offered the job, and for some reason or other, didn't take it. But they had a position, and so they broke the salary scale for that particular type of label, distinguished professor.
Well, I remember that when I remember talking to Crane, to R.S. Crane about getting Kaysen, and he said, well, it doesn't matter. He said, you won't see him, and he won't stay there.
Which is right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He knew that Kaysen had moved from place to place. I mean, that's the story of his academic life.
I see.
Moved from place to place. So, I don't think any place could have done better to try and satisfy his requirements. I mean, we arranged things to his convenience maximally, even to putting him up at Sunwood. So, and he was...
Was he a good teacher?
I think he was a good... in a large lecture situation, he would write out his lectures the way he would write out his books. That is, they would be well-crafted and eloquent. I don't think he was a very good judge of students. I think he didn't have... Well, there's a certain kind of he's got a good critical mind, but there's a certain kind of analytic approach that isn't congenial to him, and I think he was not very good. I think he was either was bowled over by a student and would say, you know, this is the best student I've ever had, or else they were terrible, and he wasn't making the kinds of discriminations that might be more careful. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Individuals who did things that were important for the future development of the university as a whole or some part of it. Wow. Well, if I think about it, I still think that in his own way, Harold Ziskin has been an extraordinary influence for good. And I mention him simply because he's such a sort of hidden figure. People have said he's the most extraordinary teacher they ever had. And my colleague Bruce Bashford, who has team taught with him four or five times now since Harold became ill, says it's just extraordinary to see the way he works with students. And that's been, you know, that kind of thing for me matters as much or more than the more obvious dimensions of institution building. Now, there's a way in which you build an ethos in an institution by the way you behave as a colleague and as a teacher. And I think he had been extraordinary. I was very pleased when he finally was recognized with the Chancellor's Award some years ago. But he...
Distinguished Teaching Award.
He got the Excellence in Teaching Award.
Excellence in Teaching.
Right. The other person who changed my life is Tom Rogers. He's a sort of quiet, self-effacing guy, but two things about him that I'm eternally grateful for. One is that he was one of the people who just sort of carried the English department on his back. There wasn't any sort of dirty work job that he wouldn't do. That other people with different attitudes would just shy away from. So that I can remember summers when he was director of composition, when he read the whole freshman class's proficiency essay and sit down with 700, 900 of these things and just do it by himself without asking for anybody. He was a wonderful director of undergraduate studies for years. Students really could talk to him, and he was very good at finding his way through the academic maze for them. But the second thing is that he's an extraordinary teacher. I taught with him remember we had the NDA institutes in the summer. We had four of them actually. I did the first two. The 60th National Defense Education Act set up a bunch. There was a big rush to improve teaching, and this was a program for setting up summer institutes for high school teachers in various fields, and we got in on it the first year. Don't you remember there was this business about running around with getting your signature for the proposal to Washington in time, and it was a sort of hairbreadth thing. Well, that was, in fact, that's the first real money grant that this institution ever got in the area of the humanities. It was $50,000 and seemed like a million at the time. So we did that, Tom and I did that together, and so I was able to watch him work with teachers and with students. And then we started visiting each other's classes, and then we sort of collaborated in our teaching. We would try to, when we were teaching sections of the same course, we would talk about assignments together and swap papers and so on. And I just learned so much from him about being a careful reader and about how to conduct a discussion. He would seem to be doing nothing, and he would get students to do the most extraordinary things. Students who you wouldn't believe were capable of it by just saying, well, would you say a little more about that? And then asking just the right question. And then I've seen him take a student who started out absolutely tongue-tied, unable to say anything about the question that he posed. And he would just stay with that student. He had an extraordinary patience. He'd stay with that student for 10 minutes, and you could see the student actually figuring things out because this guy was willing to wait until he or she figured it out. And it was really inspiring to watch him work. And one of my great regrets is that he never got any real recognition. We put him up for the teaching prize years ago, and somehow he never got it.
How is his health now?
Good. It is good, yeah. He's teaching in CED, and I saw him yesterday, and he looks exactly the same. He's still bicycling, still swimming in the Sound, he's going to Norway this summer. He tried to get a Fulbright to teach there next year, and instead he's going to take a summer course there. He's been studying Norwegian all year. You know, he studied Chinese for 3 years, and before he had his stroke. I sometimes think that might have contributed to his stroke because he was working so hard on that. He knew Japanese. He had studied Japanese in World War II in the Army, and so he had an inkling of what he was getting into, but apparently Chinese is much more complicated. So Harold Ziskind, Tom Rogers, Dick Levin in his own way, I say in his own way because I think it's been his way for the last 15 years anyway, maybe longer, to pretty much withdraw from the day-to-day affairs of the university. I mean, he does his citizenship duties in the department, but he's really mainly wrapped up in pursuing his own work.
What's his field?
Shakespeare, and he's now one of the leading Shakespeare scholars in the country. And he has, you know, he has a lot of recognition, and he really has. So he's given Stony Brook that kind of visibility. Dick Levine, I think, had a lot to do with making the English department as strong as it is today. As chairman, he was a very conscientious...
Dick Levine and Dick
Levin were both chairmen, and they're constantly getting each other's mail.
Right.
But I think Dick was chairman longer than anyone. Dick Levine, he was chairman for something like 9 or 10 years, and during a time when the department really came into full maturity, and he deserves a lot of the credit for that.
Okay. What about the administrative people?
Well, that's harder for me to talk about because I think from the faculty point of view, there's sort of a tradition here, as you probably know, of mainly griping about the administration. I think John Toll was wanted to make this place a first-class place. But he wasn't very good at relating to the faculty. Mm-hmm. I was on the Faculty Senate Executive Committee and can remember pleading with him to be more consultative with the faculty in the late 60s. And it just was not something he did very easily. And I guess the other thing that is that he really was very insensitive to kinds of things that mattered to other people. That is, he had such a strong sense of mission and of ultimate goals that he could be wading through the mud and not even be aware of it. That is, the amenity side of it didn't matter to him. And I think it was hard for him to understand how much it mattered to other people. How you know, sort of frustrating and depressing it was to be constantly seeing the place in a state of disrepair and upheaval and so on. So I think it really was a tremendous surprise to him in 67 when the students revolted about the lighting system and the mud and the catwalks and so on. I think he really hadn't noticed. because those things didn't matter.
Yeah.
And that was a liability. Marburg, I think, is more sensitive to that kind of thing. He has a stronger sort of aesthetic dimension, and I think the campus looks better. I think it's got a long way to go, but it's not positively offensive the way it used to be. And I'm not... you don't have any responsibility. I don't know. I think... I sometimes wonder whether Charlie Wagner knew what he was doing. I mean, people tell me... I don't know. I don't know how those things work, but I wonder whether some of the decisions that his office made about the layout of this campus and the... I certainly think the blacktopping was a mistake. That, I think, I don't know whether that was Charlie's doing or came after him or what. But I think blacktopping the whole center there was just makes it too urban somehow. The pleasantest parts of campus are places where you have a sense of green around you and not just lots of paving in all directions. I'm trying to think about other administrators. I guess the fact that I don't think of any is says something in itself. I'm trying to think about sort of people, you know, below the level of chief executive. I don't remember any deans with any particular...
Bob Neville, was he?
Yeah, I was never as impressed with Bob Neville as Dick Levine was. I think Dick Levine felt that he was a good dean for the English department and that he was a good dean to work with for him as chairman. I wasn't working with him as chairman, so I'd have to accept Dick's judgment on that. But I never was impressed with him as an intellectual power. I think that...
Despite his five books?
Well, you know, there are a lot of books that I don't think should have been published. I haven't read his books. I'm talking about in face-to-face conversation and so on. I think that, and I don't think he was all that good to the English department. David Sheehan, I should say, has been a good chairman too. I think we've been fortunate in our last few chairmen. I think David's conscientious and unflappable, which is absolutely essential in a chairman. Who was dean before? The other deans were...
Stan Ross, do you remember?
Yeah, I remember Stan, that's right. Well, Stan... nil nisi bonum, right?
What?
De mortuum nil nisi bonum.
Yeah.
I once said about Stan, because the thing that I remember about him was his parsimoniousness with institutional money. And I once said that I thought he ran the place like it was his own mom-and-pop candy store. I'm sure that there were reasons for that, but that was the impression I had. And he meant well. I don't have a very... I guess it's partly distance now. I don't have a very clear sense of what Stan's role was. I mean, he was very visible at the time and very active. But... And I remember him trying to get me to take a job with him. I can't remember what it was. Some kind of position in that office.
Assistant thing.
Something like that. And I remember deciding not to do it because I just didn't want to get into administration. And I remember the bravest thing he did when he tried to run for the Three Village School Board, which was a really good citizen thing to do, and a bunch of us were working for him, campaigning for him, so on. And I remember being at the election night, counting the ballots and so on, and he lost. And it said something to me about the university and the community. I think he lost because he was from the university at that point. That just, you know, you'd think somebody with his credentials you were willing to take the interest in doing it, and so on. And he had kids in the school. But he didn't get it. The light's up. The light. No, I'm just looking from the wrong angle. It's okay, still on. But I thought that was, you know, that was something he didn't have to do.
Right.
It was a good thing.
What about you in the community?
Well,
your wife is.
Yeah, she's very involved in the through the gallery.
Gallery North.
Gallery North. She really has connections with parts of the community that I would never have come into contact with if it weren't for that. That is, the gallery acts as a kind of community center, particularly with people from Oldfield who we wouldn't ordinarily see, except for the tennis club. I think that's made a big difference. I think we feel integrated in the community because of the gallery and because of our children having grown up here and been through the schools and made friends with people in the community. So that, but you know,
are
I
you
think if you live in a place for 27 years, you ought to begin to feel like part of the community.
Right. Are you typical as a family? Or do the faculty still stay pretty much to themselves?
Gee, that's... Well, if I think about social events, most of the social events that we go to connected with the gallery, or that somehow come out of the gallery in some way, or people we know through the gallery, there are very few faculty at those.
Not many faculty in the churches.
Is that right?
I think so, yeah.
Well, we don't belong to any congregation, so we're not. I don't really know anything about that. The thing with my colleagues is an awful lot of them don't live in this area. I have colleagues who live in Manhattan, Brooklyn, New Jersey. One who's been living a sort of multi-divided life between New Haven, White Plains, and here. I think they now have given up New Haven. And her husband is a psychiatrist in a hospital in White Plains. So I think they now live in White Plains. And she doesn't really commute. She's here for most of the week, and then they spend weekends together. But of the people who've been in the community the longest, Ed Feese and his family, Tom Rogers and his family, I think their friends are still mostly university people. They have friends outside the university community, but I'm still, and it may be just that I see them in the context in which that's true, but I think that's still true. And I think it's partly the nature of a suburban community. It's a dormitory community. The men aren't there most of the time. And so the networks that get built up are wives' networks. And that's apt to be based on something other than affiliation with the university. And, I think it's still an alien presence for all its having been here so long, simply because there aren't many universities I can think of that are in this peculiar community situation. I think of Penn State, for example, which is a huge university, but the community seems to be part of it.
Yeah.
It's clear the community is there because the university is there. The community was here, and the university was thrust into it. And that.
Well, give it another 30, 40 years.
Well, you know, in a way, I was thinking about Chicago. I went to I remember as a high school student going to the 50th anniversary of the University of Chicago, 1942. It's only going to be 100 years old in the next decade. I'm hoping to go to the 100th. It'd be nice to be able to say I went to the 50th and the 100th. But it shows what can happen in 50 or 75 years. I mean, I think it's amazing what's happened here in 30 years.
I think everybody feels that way. That a lot has been accomplished. A lot has been done.
And I think you asked there about people who made a difference. There's a whole cadre of people who you could, some of whom you've talked to, okay, who I think of as people who are people of goodwill, who have, if nothing else, kept the place from being worse than it might be. And I think, you know, Francis Bonner, Norm Goodman, Dick Solo, Max Dresden, people who've been willing to put time in and take their responsibilities toward the institution seriously. And the irony is, it's not an irony, I mean the truth is, that there is a small cadre of such people. It's bigger than that handful of names. But there are a lot of faculty living off those people. I mean, that's just a fact. There are a lot of faculty who take care of themselves and assume that the institution will take care of itself. Don't you think that's true?
Yes. What about faculty club? What about the interdisciplinary associations?
I don't think there's been enough of it, clearly.
Yeah.
I think coming from a place like Chicago where talk across disciplines was just taken for granted.
Yes, right.
It's I've always been struck by how departmentalized this place is. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, I tried to participate in whatever ventures the universities had that would try to break that down.
Right.
And I think it's unfortunate because when I do get to talk to people from other departments, it's interesting. The biologist from Harvard who came here, the Nobel Prize winner, Hirschberger, who was here, he gave a lecture and another talk in April.
He was
brought here by Dick Porter in chemistry. I had lunch with him because I had said I was interested in meeting him because he was supposed to be somebody interested in teaching undergraduates. And I wanted to see what a Nobel Prize winner interested in teaching undergraduates was like. And we had a very fruitful conversation at lunch. And I told him about something that I had done that he was going to go home and try with his graduate teaching assistants. And he gave me some references and so on. And I felt we were able to talk to each other, even though our disciplinary backgrounds were radically different. And I always enjoy talking to people about this. I think Ed Feist feels that way, too. I think he's always felt comfortable talking to people in the sciences. And I must say, I'm not one of those humanists who sees science as the enemy.
Good. Well, that's good. That's good. No.
So I think the place, if the place is good, as good as it is, it's due to, 20 or 30 people, maybe,
mm-hmm.
who paid their dues.
Mm-hmm.
And you've had always, I think all of us have had to constantly say to ourselves, there's a temptation to say, why should I care about it?
Mm-hmm.
If so-and-so doesn't care about it, why should I care about it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it takes a special kind of superego or something to transcend that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And a lot of morale is made it from the top.
Sure.
And there has to be leadership, not only verbal, but in behavioral
sure.
sense, too. That's, I know when it was smaller, Ann and I tried to do our part, bringing the faculty together, giving the place a a feeling of
community.
Community, right.
It's hard.
I don't know how successful we were.
It's really hard. And it's hard. I know there have been a lot of attempts, but it's somehow hard to do institutionally. That is, by even, you know, I think a faculty club is relevant, okay? Mm-hmm. I think it is. But I've gotten so used to eating my lunch in my office now that I'd have to readjust my
right.
my whole way of living. I think that it comes down to that word I used before, ethos. That is, I think there's no way that you can, just by having a structure,
mm-hmm.
make it happen. Because everyone is conscious of it being a sort of formal procedure. Somehow there has to be, what do we want to say, a change of heart. There has to be a will on the part of the people involved to want to be together. Isn't that right?
I think that's true. Yeah. You can facilitate it up to a point. I look at the humanities now, and they're scattered.
Physically scattered?
Physically scattered. What can you do about bringing them together? And does it make sense to try to bring them together? What do you think?
Oh, I think it makes a lot of sense. I'm not about to advocate that the English department be moved out of the humanities building. I think that when I talk to people in the philosophy department, I learn things.
Mm-hmm.
And I have Carol Bloom, who's in French, is in the same period that I am, 18th century, and she and I have had very useful working relations. She's helped me with some translations and things.
Mm-hmm.
It's the natural way to go. But we've somehow built up this artificial thing. And I can't help thinking that, I mean, it may seem a little strange, but I think one of the sources of the extreme departmentalization, one source obviously is the resource orientation. If you're research oriented, mm-hmm. most research is disciplinary.
Mm-hmm.
Interdisciplinary research is a rare thing. That's why I think this collegium idea that Norman Goodman is leading the way in, which I was also involved in this year, is a good idea, because it's going to try to make, to promote interdisciplinary research. But the other factor is FTEs. The fact that this place runs on FTEs is at the source of many of its problems. Because you have to set up your fief to be sure that you get your share of those things, and you don't get it by breaking down those walls. So I think that's a basic problem.
Yes.
That's a force that's pushing toward the fragmentation. Well, I've got to go because I have to see the student.
All right.
Thank you for letting me talk so much.
Well, I'm glad you came,
okay.
And you put into the record ideas that haven't come before.
Oh, good.
So this is fine.
Okay. I'm glad I ran into you, Carl.
I've got.